Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 196 of Unblocking Crypto. Al, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you, man.
Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room. So much for October. October was not an up month like September was, and we were thinking things were going to go really well. And in the past month, we've seen Bitcoin bleed off 20K worth of its price. And I think it even went under 100K yesterday. So it's kind of been interesting to watch here lately.
Yeah. No, it's Bitcoin price goes up and down. But you hit these psychological barriers at 100,000. And for people to have sell orders to drive it below, it's pretty strange. I mean, we're almost at 12 months of Bitcoin bouncing around between 100 and 125,000 for a whole year. So you've got a ton of sell pressure, and it seems like it's coming from like old whale holders that have been in it forever. But it's weird for those guys to drive the price below 100,000. So the sell pressure is coming from somewhere. I'm not sure why. It seems like with the ETFs and institutional adoption, some countries are getting into it and things like that. It's kind of a weird time to drive the price down. But that's kind of how Bitcoin rolls. It kind of does whatever you think it's not going to do. And the price goes to wherever the most pain is. And, I kind of was like, yeah, the most pain is the price bouncing around between 100 and 125. So many people were like 200,000 in 2025. And, all these speculations and guesses of where the price is going to go. I never heard anybody say, I think it's going to bounce around 100 to 125,000 for all year long. So, we'll see.
Well, it's crazy too. I mean, if you look at the network hash rate for Bitcoin, it hit a record high in October, right? So there's still a ton of miners jumping into this. The hash rate, I think it was 5% to just over 1,080 exahashes per second. And the mining difficulty was 3% higher at the end of than the end of September, and it's I think 80% higher than the difficulty heading into the most recent halving. So I mean, there's a ton of people that are getting involved, and I think like we've talked about before, usually when that happens, price follows a few months later.
Yeah, I mean, normally Bitcoin price follows the M2 money supply chart that broke off a long time ago. It's like you would think with all the macro economic tailwinds that price would keep coming up. You've got the Fed cut 25 basis points. They said that they're going to shrink the balance sheet. Which is like we're going to end quantitative tightening, which usually means they're going to increase quantitative easing, so more liquidity. They said that there's more risk to the downside for unemployment, so I'm sure they've got a lever to pull to make that look better. So liquidity coming and Bitcoin price plummeting. So that's a weird dynamic. So we'll see what happens in November in a bull year. If you think that Bitcoin cares about the calendar, November is a good month. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I think it's typically one of the top months in the calendar. Trump was on 60 Minutes here recently too, talking about he wants to make the U.S. number one crypto capital of the world. And even David Sacks had talked about crypto, calling it the industry of the future. So, I mean, there is still, this administration is very much crypto friendly and still trying to push that as much as possible.
Yeah. I mean, and they should. It's definitely an area of growth. I mean, you can't just say everything's about AI. We're going to, focus on AI. It's not the only growth industry right now.
Yeah. I did read a lot. I feel like even though Congress is shut down, the U.S. Congress people are very involved with some of the news. So we talked last week about CZ's pardon from Trump, and Elizabeth Warren kind of tweeted out saying that she was not happy with a convicted felon getting pardoned, yada, yada, yada. And so apparently CZ's lawyer said something back to Elizabeth Warren asking for a retraction and said that Mr. Zhao will not remain silent while a United States senator seemingly misuses the office to repeatedly publish defamatory statements that impugn his reputation and cause him further injury. So I think Elizabeth Warren's lawyer sent something back saying that what she said was what happened. And it's kind of just a mess at this point, but it is definitely becoming a big issue from the Democrats, where they are fighting back against anything crypto related. And she's not really the only one doing this right now either.
Yeah. And I saw that where they were considering suing her for slander, libel, whatever, you know, written or spoken. But it's one of those things, man. Every time you hear about CZ from that side, he's a money launderer. It's not, oh, he didn't follow all the regulations in the United States for anti-money laundering. You know, there's a big difference between, like, hey, your company didn't do everything right by the book, and you're taking illegal funds and laundering them. And so they keep saying that. And I think that CZ and his attorneys are going to have enough, and they're going to kind of start going after people for saying that.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you can look back in history on a lot of the big banks and how they've actually been caught laundering money. Yet there's not a single person from one of those banks that have ever been charged for doing something improperly. So it's interesting how they can say, hey, CZ and Binance is the problem. But all the big banks that do this all the time, we're just going to say they're going to get a pass again.
Oh, yeah. Banks don't ever really pay a penalty, man. Like, if they lose money, they get bailed out. If they do illegal stuff, then they pay a fine and nobody goes to jail universally. So, you know, when you're like crypto, like if CZ were to have done the similar thing, but at a bank, then we maybe never would have heard of it.
Yeah. I did see, too, that Ro Khanna, who's the California lawmaker, he is trying to announce a plan to ban elected officials from owning or creating cryptocurrencies, calling it a response to the corruption concerns that a lot of this deals with, what Trump's family had done and what happened with the pardon of CZ, which he calls a blatant corruption, which is, we just talked about, kind of crazy. He also previously authored the 2023 Banned Congressional Stock Trading Act, which never went anywhere. So it's like, okay, I hear you, right? You want to ban all these people, but man, the stock side is the craziest part right now. You look at freaking Nancy Pelosi, and she's making a freaking killing, and she's not the only one, but there's even stock markets or index funds that you can track all of her buys and sells and destroy the market if you want to these days.
Yeah, I think she's up like 45% this year in the Nancy Pelosi stock trading, like the mirrored stock trading vehicle. I don't know if they have an ETF or not, but they have an app that'll automatically adjust your portfolio to look like Nancy Pelosi's and it crushes it. So yeah, but don't worry, that's not real corruption. Look over there. Look at crypto. Look at the other guys. So yeah.
Everybody else.
Yep.
And then the last one that I saw from the Congress side of things was Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, that I think he came after Coinbase and said that their $46 million donation into elections and contributions was all connected to Trump's corruption factory. And Coinbase kind of came back and said, look, we donated to both sides. They donated to a PAC. There's three, I think, Democrats that he's sitting with that were there because of what Coinbase did. And the ballroom donations went through the trust corporations among various industries did the same thing. So I think the Coinbase guy came back and said, it may be that you just don't like our industry. That's unfortunate, given that we're working hard to ensure that the U.S. financial system is on the front edge of innovation, which it almost seems like Democrats have been not wanting the U.S. to be at the front end of innovation for a long time.
Yeah, Democrats seem to be just riding the pendulum swing that's coming from the Trump election. And so they've always been, whatever Trump says, we're the opposite, but it's going to crank up a lot coming into this midterm stuff. You know, we just had elections yesterday. Mamdani won the mayoral seat in New York. You know, so you're going to see like the most opposite you can be from Trump stuff, plus blame Trump and Trump-like stuff for everything. And so that's kind of what this is. Like, yeah, this guy's putting the same money in his pocket that the red team is putting in their pocket. However they spend it, it doesn't matter. I mean, like the blue team, the Biden election, when he was still campaigning, they paid a guy $4 million to work on the campaign. And if he won, there was going to be another $4 million. That's a ton of money to give somebody for an election campaign that only lasts, 16 to 18 months. Like, money just flows through these organizations. For them to be upset about $46 million being spent here or there, there's every penny of that on the blue team. Like, it's the same game. Like, the more you get into Bitcoin, the more you start to pay attention to macroeconomics and kind of the social side of things, the proof of work stuff, the more you're like, all this politics stuff is, it's one game played by two sides. And the more they can get people to be upset with the other team, the less they realize what the real problems are. So, like, this quabbling over $46 million is kind of funny because we're printing $1 trillion every 90 or 120 days. 90 days. Yeah. So,
quite a $37 trillion deficit. I'm worried about $46 million.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, and the red team tried to get in there and find all these little fraud and abuse pockets, all these non-government organizations that are just literally a grift. And the blue team fought them every step of the way. Like, they don't actually care about this. It's just something he can get a soundbite so that he could be, look at me on the blue team, and the red, blue team good, red team bad, is all he's trying to say. So if people don't understand this by now, like, it's over. they're not going to get it.
Custodia was in the news too. We talked last week about the skinny master accounts idea that one of their Fed governors had an idea on. Well, the 10th Circuit judge upheld the Federal Reserve's right to discretion in approving or denying master account access in the Custodia case. It was a 2-1 vote against Custodia. So, I mean, I guess there at least was one judge that said this isn't right. I think it still has to go to the 9th Circuit before it goes to the Supreme Court review. And I was reading a little bit about, I think TD Cowen came out and said this is kind of just a temporary setback for what we believe over time will be the merging of the traditional finance system with crypto. And if you look at what the Trump administration and the regulators there have been doing with merging these sectors, it's hard not to see how this doesn't happen at some point. So, and the skinny master account might be the answer, but it's apparently going to take a little while longer, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much money running around and like banking lobbyists and things like that. It's an uphill battle for those guys.
You just talked about New York. Kalshi was in the news too, which is the prediction platform. I think Dami had like 95% chance of winning on those platforms, by the way. Yeah. So once again, they're pretty accurate. But they just sued New York regulators. And apparently there was, they're trying to sue them ahead of time so that the state's gaming commission can't treat their sports prediction markets as illegal gambling. And they're doing this almost preemptively because in Nevada, crypto.com got sued by, or got a cease and desist letter from the Nevada Gaming Commission. So I think they're just trying to get ahead of it and frame the narrative, but it'll be interesting. I think Nevada threatens, I don't know, I think it was New York threatened civil penalties unless Kalshi halted sports event contracts. So I think that's why Kalshi had sued New York.
Yeah, when you step on the toes of the mafia's gambling profits, you're probably going to get pushback. So I think that's par for the course for like a disruptor coming in and things like that. So they're going to have to deal with all that sort of stuff. That's not a surprise.
One of the more interesting things that I saw too, Citibank and Coinbase just announced they're going to be partner up. Their goal is to enhance digital asset payment capabilities for institutional clients, and that will focus mainly on the fiat pay-in to payouts and bridging some of the traditional finance with crypto on and off ramps, which would be amazing once it comes to everybody else other than just institutional clients. I know Citi has talked about planning to launch custody solutions in 2026, but this global network payment would leverage Citi's network across 94 markets and provide 24/7 access to smoother crypto-related money transfers for the bank's institutional customers. And after what happened with Silicon Valley Bank not too long ago, there needs to be something like this out there. So Citi could be the answer, which would be awesome.
A quick break from the podcast to talk about a little PDF I put together for everybody. I've been in crypto since about 2018 and made a lot of mistakes. And the one thing I always get asked is, what would you do differently if you got in today? So what I've done is created a PDF that talks about the 10 mistakes that I've made and how not to make those mistakes ever again. If you're interested, you can check the link in the show notes or go to www.jasonexplainscrypto.com/10 and get access to that PDF. That's the number 10, not spelled out. Back to the podcast.
Yeah. And I mean, we, you know, we talked about a lot of things banking wise, but we haven't talked about Citi very much here and there, but not a lot. So it's good to see them. I mean, they got a relationship with Coinbase. You know, Coinbase has done an awesome job of putting their name in the boardrooms and conference rooms of like every major player in crypto. You know, they're custodying a ton of the ETF stuff. They're doing a good job. As long as they don't screw up and have a problem, a hack or a freaking something, then I think they could be just huge potential in this in the market, or like going forward, it could be a huge benefit.
Yeah. Another company we haven't talked about a lot is Western Union, and they just made a pretty big announcement on the stablecoin side of things. They are planning to launch a US dollar backed stablecoin on Solana's blockchain next year. I think the new token right now is going to be called USDPT, or US dollar payment token. It'll be issued by Anchorage Digital Bank, and Western Union has 100 million customers that will be able to send money internationally without exposure to the local currency volatility. I think they have just submitted something to get the WUUSD token too. So they want to call it the Western Union USD token, I guess. So we'll see what happens. But I mean, that's pretty big news for Western Union to jump into this space now too.
Yeah. I think Western Union's in trouble if they don't. And I mean, honestly, once Strike did their thing and they were doing cross-border payments and Tether was started doing their thing, and now that Tether's going in the United States, I think the Western Union has a choice. They can be Polaroid cameras, right? Or they can pivot, change. And honestly, I mean, what a gig. You got your own stable coin, you're buying treasuries with it, it's making profit. You don't need all of this infrastructure. You can sell your real estate or pivot somehow on that side and see what happens. So at least they're doing something. They're not just going to die on the vine, which is kind of where they were headed. I do think it's interesting they chose the Solana ecosystem and not the Ethereum, since stablecoins on Ethereum seem to be very popular. So it's kind of the race to the bottom, get to the cheapest, fastest, even if it has a history of not working all the time kind of thing. So we'll see. Good for Western Union for not just like, no, this is who we are. This is what we do. This is what we've been doing for 150 years. We're going to keep doing it and go out of business. So at least they got their head on.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about Athena. A couple weeks ago, they depegged, I think back on like October 10th. They have since lost over 40% of its market cap since then. So depegging is definitely not a good thing for stablecoins. It'll be interesting to see if they can ever recover, but there's definitely, I think, a lot of lost credibility from that happening.
Yeah, you can't do that. the depegging is like the downfall. I mean, like, what was it? Terra Luna depegged, and then that was almost like the pin that popped the bubble for all of the 3 years capital, Terra Luna, you know, just garbage, Celsius, blah, blah, all the way down the list. So yeah, if you're a stablecoin, you need to be worth a dollar or whatever it is you're pegged to. Once you lose it, like it's not like it's kind of over. It's a wrap.
We've talked a little bit about World Liberty Financial. They launched the USD One coin in the past 2 months. They launched a program to try to drive some of the trading activity, and it's driven over $500 million in trading activity. USD One is now the sixth largest stablecoin. Well, in response to that program, World Liberty is going to distribute just over 8 million WLFI governance tokens to some of the early participants. So, I mean, I guess good for them. Don't know if the governance tokens have or what the value of those are, but still, I mean, it's kind of an airdrop to say thank you for being involved in getting them to the sixth largest stablecoin at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. for, I don't know. The stablecoin market's kind of getting crowded. I'd imagine in the next 12 months, we have some issues. Some people drop out and some people get acquired and there's some consolidation. I mean, it's like a natural maturing of the market. Some people are going to screw up. I don't know who. So if you're a stablecoin provider, there's money to be made. But honestly, it's not like, oh, if you pick the right stablecoin, you're good. And there's a way to invest in it. I don't really see that. So if you pick the wrong stablecoin to hold your dollars in, you can get wrecked. But it's not like you're going to get upside if you get the right one. So, you know, stablecoins would be something that I would use transactionally, like get in and get out and get back into, you know, something that you've got custody of.
Yeah, if you can invest in the company that owns the stablecoins, that's one thing. But yeah, the stablecoin is going to stay stable, hopefully. And the only thing that it usually does is go down when bad things happen. So before we talk about Tether, which is the largest stablecoin out there, Standard Money, which is the developer of the BNB chain-based stablecoin USDSD, it just raised $8 million in a strategic investment round. So USDSD is a yield-seeking algorithmic stablecoin based on Tether's USDT, which USDT, of course, is the largest stablecoin by market cap. But this is interesting that it's another algorithmic stablecoin, which those have not had a very good history of surviving. So they, I think, have caused some problems in the past. And I'll be intrigued to see how this one's different and where it goes from here.
Yeah, anytime there's this many players, we use the word stablecoin a lot today. It's like, all right, just wake me up when some of them fail and some of them grow. And they'll come up with some neat innovation. They'll scam some people. You know what I mean? I kind of know where this thing's headed. It's something's going to work. Like as far as use cases go, stablecoins are brilliant. I think that there's a ton of room for it, but only a couple are going to survive.
Well, speaking of one that's definitely going to survive, Tether is looking amazing these days. So in the first three quarters of the year, they have announced $10 billion in profit, which is more than Bank of America. And it is getting very close to the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanleys of the world. So, considering they're not that old, they're based in El Salvador, they are doing quite well for themselves these days.
Yeah, and considering the fact that those companies have tens or hundreds of thousands of employees and Tether has like 200 and something.
Yeah.
So it's pretty wild.
So let's talk about some of the ETFs still in the government shutdown here in the US. But during the government shutdown last week, there were a handful of ETFs that went live, including Bitwise's Solana ETF, ESOL. It had $56 million in day one volume, which is the most among almost 850 ETFs that have launched this year, which is kind of wild. That's amazing. And their day two volume went up to 72 million. So it actually grew. Most of the ETFs drop after day one. But this one had a wildly successful ETF launch. And it's amazing that it happened during government shutdowns.
Yeah. As of this morning, they have $80 million in inflows, which is stout. Especially like, you know, Bitwise, if you look at them compared to iBit on their spot Bitcoin ETF, you know, they're way smaller than the biggest players. You know, Bitwise is not a Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, you know, it's not a legacy blue blood player. So for them to kind of put these numbers up, I think it's great for them. I really like those guys. I like how they come on into like Bitcoin and crypto spaces and talk and kind of get their message out. What they say is reasonable. It's bridging the gap between like kind of the Bitcoin ethos and the, you know, suits of the world. And so I think I like those guys. I think they're doing a good job.
Yeah, if you kind of compare some of the other stuff that happened from the Solana. So Grayscale had their GSOL. It was a converted closed-end fund that is now an ETF. It did $4 million. All right, so way less than what we're talking about the Solana ones. Rex had a Solana staking ETF that came out, I think, a day later, SSK, but it only did about $18 million on Wednesday. So that first mover advantage is huge. And we talked about BlackRock and iBit. Even when they came out, it was, what, eight or nine of them that came out at the same time. So Solana got that one-day advantage from everybody else, and it seems to be doing really well. And you also had other ETFs go live too, like Canary had their Hedera and their Litecoin ETF go live, and I haven't really paid too much attention to it, but it's interesting with the SEC changing their rules that after 20 days or whatever, that they can automatically go live if there's nothing else. So we're probably going to start to see a lot more of these go live in the next few weeks too.
Yeah, and you know, the reason why, like, the first mover advantage, and you know, where do the funds flow, which one? Because if you look at the options market for IBIT, it is pretty good. Like, you got strike prices way up and down the ladder, you got a lot of liquidity, there's a lot of availability. And if you look at Bitwise's Bitcoin ETF, as far as like trying to do a cover call strategy or whatever, like, it just kind of falls apart on the options chain as you get farther and farther out of the money, because there's just not as much activity. So if they, you know, if they're trying to, I mean, everybody's trying to get an options market. That's kind of how this works, is just to keep interest going. But it's a big deal to get that early advantage, more funds flowing. And so, you know, people that are interested in options are going to, 100% of them are going to come to you. None of them are going to go to the guys that, where they don't have enough liquidity at the different strike prices and expiration dates.
Yeah. So I think last week, if you look at all the Solana ETFs, there was about $421 million in inflows. The Bitcoin ETFs had about $946 million in outflows. So much different. Granted, it's still, that's almost a small number for Bitcoin compared to some of the other weeks that they've had. IBIT was $400 million of that, so almost half of it. Mm-hmm. So IBIT had the same amount of outflows that all of Solana had in inflows, pretty much. Ethereum was pretty much about even. I think they had $19 million of inflows, which was interesting to see. Didn't have the huge outflows that Bitcoin had. And there seems to be this focus on privacy from Ethereum that is gathering a lot of attention. They just created a new 47-member privacy cluster. So that is becoming more important, especially if you look at like Zcash. Zcash, we've talked about Bitcoin going down from 120 something to 100K in the past month. Zcash since September has like 7x. So it's been on a little bit of a tear, and it is definitely one of those privacy coins that should even jump Monero's market cap here recently too.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't had Zcash on my brain in a long time, so I would have guessed that they were going down. So
yeah,
7x in 2 months is a big deal.
Yeah. Let's talk about some treasury companies. So Strategy bought some more Bitcoin, 397 Bitcoin for just over $45 million. They now hold 641,205 Bitcoin.
That is nice. They also sold some common shares. The stock price is down into the, well, at the time of that, it was like in the 270s range. Now it's in the 240s range because we had a price drop in Bitcoin. But they've done a couple of things in addition to just buying Bitcoin. They launched STRE, a European preferred. So similar to the US versions, where you buy it, it pays out a dividend, and you're done. But it provides liquidity for Strategy to buy Bitcoin for the balance sheet. And so that's interesting. I mean, it's a whole nother pool of money that they haven't had a chance to get into because they're all US-based. I think that you'll find European companies that are interested in something like this. I don't know how much, but the longer Strategy can kind of get a track record, the better. They had their Q3 earnings call and basically said they're not going to do, well, they indicated they're not going to do any more convertible notes, and they're going to roll off their convertible notes through 2029. And so they're kind of evolved from the convertible notes to these preferreds. I think that's fine. Convertible notes got them to here, and they got them there quick with these big billion-dollar purchases, multi-billion-dollar purchases. And but if you look at kind of how they're doing things now, especially in the last few weeks, they haven't been selling a ton of common shares. So I think they're headed in the right direction there. And there was a lot of talk about the return of capital tax treatment of the dividends. So the 10% dividend, you know, it's a lot of it is the sale of shares. So the dividend is actually not taxed. It's considered return of capital, which is basically giving you your money back. basically at the end of 10 years, your cost basis is zero. So when you sell now, your capital gains, you know, you got to pay your capital gains, but you're not paying short-term capital gains on a dividend like you would normally as ordinary income. So there's a benefit there. You could always gift it or whatever, but it's worth noting 10% tax-free is killing everything else on the market if you consider it to be like a fixed income asset. So that's something to watch. I mean, you know, the problem with strategy is Michael Saylor believes one thing and the market isn't there yet. So he could be early and right and still have problems.
Yeah, I feel like that's been most of the Bitcoin community for a while.
Yeah, no kidding.
So another company that we don't talk about as being a treasury company, but they're actually a pretty big one, is Coinbase. So you just talked about strategies, profits. Coinbase announced they made $433 million in profit last quarter. They used $300 million of that to buy Bitcoin. So they now hold over 14,500 Bitcoin worth just over $1.5 billion. So decently large size treasury company at this point that I guess I almost forget about Coinbase being one of those.
Yeah, they're like the unconventional Bitcoin strategy company where they actually have a huge operating business and they use it to just stack Bitcoin. And so it kind of gets lost. But yeah, I mean, they hold quite a bit of Bitcoin. And, you know, put on a list of things like Coinbase, you know, a lot of people like to kind of hate on them, but it's not like they do a ton of stuff straight up wrong.
I think they're definitely one of those companies. And I think there's a lot of other people that are expecting them to do big things and follow a strategy into being a $1 trillion company in the future.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Stake and Shake, another Bitcoin treasury company, they just announced that all the payments received in Bitcoin will now be added to their strategic Bitcoin reserve. So it will be kind of a fun way for them to do that. Also, if you order a Bitcoin meal, they are going to donate 210 sats for every meal to their reserve. And then if you purchase and register the Bitcoin Steak Burger through the Fold app, you'll also get $5 in free Bitcoin. So there's, I think, some instructions provided on the receipts, but it's pretty simple to do. And I've already talked to a buddy of mine that's done it, and I'm kind of intrigued to go do that here in the near future as well.
Yeah, I like Steak and Shake. We have one here, and during baseball season, we're there a lot. It's kind of close to some of the fields. And yeah, like, you know, all of these people don't spend your Bitcoin. It's like, if you spend dollars, you're spending dollars that could have been Bitcoin. So it doesn't matter. That's a crazy thought that everybody keeps talking about. I'm like, this is the dumb, like, opportunity cost is real. It doesn't matter what you do. You're spending Bitcoin no matter if you spend dollars. Like, stop thinking otherwise. It's dumb. The only way around it is to not spend. And I am not going to sit in my house and sit on the floor and stare at the walls just so I can have more Bitcoin. So anyway, I like Steak and Shake. I like what they're doing.
I think the only problem right now is, since we don't have the minimum tax exemption, is theoretically if you spend it, there is a tax consequence, which is stupid. So
yeah, but I think honestly, the only way out of that is to spend it, deal with the tax consequences if you have to, because if it's over $600 a year, and then eventually it'll be a problem enough that the government has to do something about it. It's like, the government's not going to preemptively get in front of an issue. You know what I mean? It's like, they're just a bunch of loser freaking dolts. Like, the issue has to be a big deal before they actually do anything to solve it. So everybody knows it'll be an issue, but they're not interested in that.
Yeah, government being proactive. That's an interesting way of looking at things, yeah. Yeah. Going back to some of the treasury companies, so Bitmine, we've talked about Strategy being the largest Bitcoin holder. Bitmine's the largest Ethereum. They added another 80,000 Ethereum, about $294 million to their treasury last week. They now hold more than 2.8% of the entire Ethereum supply, which is just under 3.4 million ETH. Their goal, I think, is still to get to 5% of the supply, and their shares have continued to slide quite a bit as well. I think they were down like 8%. Last week too, just the world going crazy lately.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have any dry powder left, you know, keep an eye on some of these things. And if the MNAV gets under one, you know, if you're not leveraged in other ways, it's kind of a decent way to leverage your way into some some positions. But yeah, right now, man, it's like, it's just weird times. Like everything's, you know, everything's just long-term. Just think long-term. But I, if you ask me to explain why I think the price is at $100,000 in Bitcoin and, you know, other cryptos kind of follow that path, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it should be. So just wait, you know. And there's, if I was bullish about Bitcoin in 2020 through 2022, you know, or 2023, there's no way I should be bearish after the ETFs announced in 2024. So
yeah,
like it's just a matter of time.
So Sharp Link Gaming is another one of the Ethereum treasury companies. They just made an interesting announcement. They're planning to deploy about $200 million worth of their Ether onto Linea, which is the layer two Ethereum network. It's apparently going to be like a multi-year program that pairs Ether.fi staking with iGen Cloud restaking rewards and ecosystem incentives. They're going to do this while keeping the institutional controls under Anchorage Digital, who's custodying it. They didn't really quote the returns, but the research that I kind of looked on is there's some up to like 20% returns that you can get on some of those Linea staking programs. So that's kind of interesting. And I mean, that's a lot for a treasury company to be getting with money that's kind of sitting in and their stake.
Yeah, Terra Luna was good about giving 20% returns until they were no longer good at it. So just a heads up, if the Fed funds rate is at 4 and you're getting 20, there's risk. You're in, that premium is being paid on risk.
Yeah, ETHZilla is another one of the treasury companies for Ethereum. They did an interesting thing where they sold about $40 million of their Ethereum to repurchase the shares because they were trading below the MNEV. So, and I think there was one of their investors penned an open letter and they put it on X and they said, oh yeah, we're already doing that. So kind of an interesting thing. And then Orange BTC in Brazil did kind of the same thing for their Bitcoin reserve as well. So kind of interesting to see companies doing that, taking advantage of that.
I mean, I suppose, but if your company is based on Bitcoin reserve and you're based on the price of Bitcoin and you sell Bitcoin in order to boost your stock price, you know, it's a shell game, you know. It's, you're not really securing much, you know. If you're providing the sell pressure in the bear market, like if the price goes down, we'll sell. It's like, ooh, that means the price is going to go down faster. That's not great for you and then your stock price. So I don't know how I feel about it. It seems like, you know, as the price goes down, it's a good time to buy. I bought Bitcoin last week. I had to sell other stuff because I'm as in as I can be. So I'm like, you know what? I've got some retirement fund stuff that is just in boring QQQs or whatever. And I'm like, okay, I'll get out of QQQs and get into more Bitcoin. So that's like, now is the time to buy. Like, especially if you're in a retirement account, you're thinking about 10, 15, 20 years. Like 100,000 is going to be kind of low.
Yeah. Like ETHZilla and Orange BTC are kind of been paying attention to what Apple's been doing over all these years, or just constantly buying back their stock. So
they're buying it back with operating profit. So it's like, that's quite different than buying it back with your treasury and not having any operating funds. Like that's different. And I mean, you know, like the investment thesis is, you know, invest in us. We've got Ethereum or Bitcoin on the balance sheet and we're going to do something with it in the future. If you have less Ethereum or Bitcoin in the balance sheet, you can do less of that on the future. So you're like, it's not a good signal to me. If I were a stockholder in a company that was buying their stock back right now, I would like, why are you selling low? Like they would be, it just doesn't make sense to me. So it's fine. Some of these treasury companies will sell and buy back their shares and some won't. So let's see what happens.
Yeah, I don't think it's either one of those is anything you and I are really paying attention to or investing in. So it's not a problem there.
Yeah.
TON Strategy, which is a TON treasury company. TON is one of the tokens for the open network. They just got warned by NASDAQ for violating shareholder approval rules after they raised over $500 million through a private stock sale to buy more Ton coin. So Ton Strategy, which is formerly Verb Strategy, apparently they're on the verge of being delisted from NASDAQ. After they announced this crypto pivot, their stock has plunged over 80%. So just because you do a digital asset treasury doesn't mean you're going to do well with that company. And I think we've been talking about a lot of these companies have been trying to find a way out, and they think this is the way out and trying to do something different. And it hasn't been the way for everybody.
Yeah, file that one under oops. Like we leapt before we looked on how to manage this thing. Like not understanding the regulations and getting delisted is bad.
Let's talk about some world news. So Japan actually had a really interesting announcement. They inked a deal with Canaan, which will supply Bitcoin mining rigs to a major Japanese utility and for a grid stability research project. And this is going to be the country's first publicly disclosed state-linked mining initiative. And we've been talking about this for years on how Bitcoin mining can help with all the power companies and flatten out the curve with the demand. And now Japan is kind of jumping into it. And it didn't say which one. I think the research, everybody thinks it's the Tokyo one. But that's a really big announcement.
Yeah. No, I feel like that you're going to see more and more stuff like that as time rolls on. So, and also, man, we don't talk about Japan very much in general. I mean, considering, you know, when I was growing up in public school, we started learning Japanese because the Japanese industry was booming and you had like Sony and all these Japanese companies that were starting to take over the world, and then it didn't. But I mean, there's been this, you know, it's a very techno forward culture, and we don't talk to them nearly as much as like South Korea. We talk about way more often than Japan. So good for them for like having their head up, paying attention.
Yeah. Speaking of South Korea, their central bank just sounded the alarm on won denominated stablecoins, warning that private issuers lack the institutional trust required to maintain stable currency and urging banks to take on the lead instead. And I just kind of laughed and I was like, oh, institutional trust from banks. Yes, that's definitely the problem that we have. So yeah, I think they compared some of the historical currency failures from America's mid-19th century free-ranking era to Korea's own Dongjibon crisis that they mentioned. So they said currency operates not on technology, but on trust. And I was like, man, you are all of a sudden just pitching why people are becoming Bitcoin believers. So if it's just based on trust, that's what everybody that's a Bitcoin believer has been talking about for a while.
Yeah, I mean, the Bitcoin mantra is, you know, verify, don't trust, because trust is a winner. It's almost like, hey, trust the banks. You're used to us screwing you over. You're used to all of our fraudulent stuff. These guys are going to do new fraudulent stuff. Come use us. We'll give you our normal games where we win and you lose. Don't worry about it. You know, don't trust those guys. They're going to screw you in different ways than you're used to. Let us continue to mess with you. So no, that's kind of dumb. That's like if there's a central authority saying, look, don't go to Netflix, go to Blockbuster. Like Blockbuster's going to end up coming out with a streaming service. I'm sure it'll be fine. You know, Blockbuster, you trust them. Don't trust Netflix. Maybe they mail stuff. Maybe they mail DVDs and maybe they don't. Like, don't trust them. It's just dumb. It's just not how innovation works, right? Like, people are going to trust it with a small amount of their net worth. Some people are going to go in a bigger way. Over the course of 5 years, there's going to be trust built. Well, like, you know, people bank with new banks all the time. People change banks all the time. Like, you trust a different bank. Okay, so I'm going to trust a stablecoin issuer with 0.1% of my net worth as I'm doing transactions for a business or whatever the reason is. That you're going to trust them as much as you trust them, and then over time you're going to trust them more and more. That's how it works. So that's just an industry stifling thing. That just sounds like banking lobbyist money got into some pockets.
Well, that's a common theme across in all countries these days. Hong Kong was also in the news. Their top financial regulator said they're going to allow local crypto trading platforms to connect with global liquidity through shared order books as the city is pushing to become a crypto hub, which is kind of interesting. So, it, I mean, it's a huge shift from their current model, which orders are pre-funded and settled within the borders, which means that you could only have liquidity with just the people in Hong Kong, which it, to me has been crazy that it's been happening this entire time. And how do you consider yourself a crypto hub if that's what you've been doing?
Yeah, we're a local crypto hub that doesn't interact globally. I think you're missing a key feature in the benefits of crypto.
Australia was also in the news too. Their financial regulator just issued a major update to their digital assets guidance. It's expanding on some of the existing financial services laws to apply to crypto businesses as the government is really preparing for this sweeping new legislation they've been talking about. I think what they have also said is that the Australian law is going to apply to offshore and decentralized structures as if they're marketed or sold to local users. So which will be interesting with the whole DeFi place. How is this going to play? How is Australia going to regulate DeFi people and say that Australians can't use them? So the government apparently says they want Australia to be a leader in digital assets, but they're still all about balancing customers' protections and innovation. So they, at the end of the day, they don't want to end up with a big value transfer away from the local customers and businesses, offshore providers, but they sure are kind of headed that way, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, Australia hasn't been doing a fabulous job lately. So put this on the list of them continuing to kind of flounder a little bit.
Another kind of hopping different part of the world, the Nordic area. There's a big bank up there, Nordea Bank. They just announced they're going to offer its customers access starting in December of 2025 to a synthetic exchange-traded product whose underlying asset is in Bitcoin. So this is one of the larger banks in the Nordic area. They have around $650 billion in assets. So, I mean, that's great to see European banking customers in the Nordic area will have access to putting their money in Bitcoin. And I know it's synthetic, but it's still at least a place to start.
Yeah, like those Nordic countries have kind of, they're all right, you know? We talk mostly positive about those guys. They seem to not be shutting themselves off and things like that. So that's all right.
Well, I mean, you look at their sovereign wealth funds and they've been ahead of a lot of other countries in dipping their toe into Bitcoin. So they seem to be leading the charge over there. But speaking of Europe, their central bank has just been told to accelerate the process of developing the digital euro. So this is the CDBC that we've been talking about. The European Parliament is, I think, looking to pass the necessary regulations in 2026, and then they're going to pilot the digital euro in 2027, and if it's successful, it will be formally rolled out across Europe in 2029. So I laugh that they are accelerating it, and we're talking about something that's 4 years away. In the crypto world, is a lifetime.
And we may find that it's 4 years away 2 years from now as well, if they're as good at keeping a schedule as all the other government stuff. So color me not too concerned about this.
So we've talked about Securitize. They are a RWA company that's the firm behind BlackRock's Buildable Fund, which is, I think, like almost $3 billion at this point. They are eyeing a NASDAQ debut through a SPAC deal. They'll trade under SECZ. I think the proposed merger would value Securitize at $1.25 billion. Which is a lot considering that about a year ago, we're just barely talking about what Securitize is. So more positive momentum for the RWA space and another company that is kind of jumping into that and taking advantage of it.
Yeah. And, you know, we've been talking to RWAs like it's, you know, it's a no-brainer. It's around the corner, but it's still around the corner. But it's, I mean, it pops up almost every week.
We haven't talked much about the IPOs here lately, but Consensus, who is the parent company of MetaMask, one of the Ethereum wallets, they are now talking to JP Morgan and Goldman about doing an IPO following in the Geminis and the Circles and all that, with all the possible momentum of IPOs in the crypto space.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you're late. Like these IPOs, this public money seems to have been exhausted. These crypto treasury companies, Bitcoin treasury companies, don't seem to have nearly as much liquidity available to them as they did before. So good luck.
So the other thing that's been interesting too is Cameco Brands, they are planning to do a reverse merger with Perk Group, which is a Singapore-based fintech focused on artificial intelligence solutions. They actually have a very large portfolio of digital assets, and doing this would gain access to you and U.S. investors. I mean, we just talked about how everybody wants access with the IPO. They apparently hold over $500 million in digital assets. I mean, CryptoPunks are definitely one of those, right? And they've made over 400 minority investments in Web3 companies like Kraken and MetaMask and Ledger. So they're an interesting company that was almost an NFT brand that has turned into just a huge influence in the Web3 space. So I'm kind of intrigued to see where things go if they do this reverse merger and get now listed on an exchange.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if we didn't just have all this price depression, I might be like, oh man, good timing. But I am like, you might be catching the, you know, you might be in a 3-year waiting period if you're launching right now.
MasterCard got in the news again. We've been talking about them every other week, it seems like. They are reportedly acquiring a crypto and stablecoin infrastructure startup, Zero Hash, in a deal that could total up to about $2 billion. And we talked, I think, maybe earlier in October, that MasterCard and Coinbase were engaged in a bidding war for BDNK, which is a stablecoin market startup, for about $2 billion. It looks like Coinbase is in the process of working through that. So MasterCard has kind of moved on to Zero Hash, but you got two large companies going after more stablecoin infrastructure companies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, MasterCard needs to make a move, just like Western Union has got to make a move. So, you know, they got to figure it out.
Ripple just made another acquisition. We've been talking about them a lot this year. I think since April this year, they've acquired three other companies for a total of about $2.5 billion. This latest acquisition is a digital wallet provider and custody firm called Palisade. They have not released the terms of the deal, but they're saying that this acquisition is going to increase the firm's custody capacity and allow Ripple to better serve crypto native firms, financial services companies, and other corporations. So, and they apparently have kind of a printing press, and they keep buying more and more to grow as well.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, we talked about stablecoins a bunch in the first part of this podcast, and we finally got to a Ripple thing. Like, I don't, you know, Ripple's going to have to set themselves apart and figure out what their benefit is, you know, using XRP. And I don't know, I haven't really been trying to find one, but I haven't really found a great business case for why Ripple is going to do what they want to do and beat everything else, stable coins included. So I know that they have a very strong community, and I think that it was like how things used to work really well in cryptocurrency, when you had like a big strong Reddit page or a lot of people on your Discord. And now it's how many institutions are you talking to every day, and how many big time money movers and market makers do you have their phone number in your phone? And so they do a pretty good job of that. Like, they seem to play in those circles, but they're going to have to explain a lot. I mean, and especially if the regulators come out with if the stablecoins are way more trusted because of regulation ahead of, you know, what do we do with these kind of security type things and these tokens? So I don't know. I maybe I'm not reading the right stuff coming out of XRP marketing material, but it's tough for me to be like, yeah, they're it's a no-brainer. XRP and Ripple are going to crush it. So I don't know. I am also actively not paying attention to a bunch of crypto stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of the same way with Ripple and XRP, but oh well, maybe we'll get educated one day from somebody. We talked about Mega ETH a few weeks ago. They were doing a public token sale, and I think they kind of directly sold out within like 30 minutes, something crazy. Well, it ended up being oversubscribed by almost 28x more than they anticipated or had available. So they refunded everybody that didn't put the max bid in. and now they're working on allocation. So it's kind of wild that that happened, and interesting to see that there's still a ton of interest in, I guess, ICO things coming out.
Yeah. That 28x oversubscribed is pretty telling. That's, you either didn't know your market and just picked a number that was too low, or something happened and there's a bunch of money available to you. So that's a weird one.
So I'm sure everybody's been hearing about AI. There's this AI agents concept that seems to be coming to Ethereum, because there's a bunch of engineers from MetaMask and Coinbase and Google and the Ethereum Foundation that just made a case for on-chain AI agents being an ERC-8004, which allows builders and users to mint AI agents like their NFTs and delegate them using the ERC-721 rails. So it allows AI agents to be discoverable, and they can hold their reputation scores on chain. They can use the X402, which is an open payment protocol that Coinbase developed, and it could really be something that is going to be intriguing for the future, right? I mean, there's really probably only two ways for this to happen. And one is for the U.S. government to make it happen. And the other is having infrastructure that's owned by nobody, which is kind of what blockchain is. So like we talked about, I don't expect the U.S. government to get ahead of anything. Right? So putting it all on the blockchain is going to be interesting, and where we are used to paying subscription fees to get things done, if all of a sudden you're using AI agents to do that, it's going to be a really cool feature, possibly, when that happens.
Yeah, the AI stuff is going to touch everything. So no surprise there. I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to offloading some of the stuff to AI, and especially when it's trustworthy and it'll actually get things right at a high clip, at least as much. You got to get it right at least as often as I do, because getting things wrong sucks. So, but yeah, once AI gets involved, I think there's a place for it. I mean, David Sacks is the like AI and crypto czar, because they are linked. So let's see what happens.
Yeah, Donut Labs just raised about $22 million to build an AI browser that can analyze markets and execute trades on its own. And I was reading a little bit about that, and it's going to be kind of one of those things where you're going to have different people have different things that they're looking at and trying to do. So you're teaching this AI to go do something on how you believe it should be done. And it's going to be intriguing to see how this happens, because then you don't have to spend all this time searching at things and looking at things. The AI is going to be like, oh yeah, he likes to do this, so we'll do it based on the rules that he created. And that's going to be kind of life-changing, I think, for a lot of people.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, like, even all the way down to just like setting Google alerts to alert you when something pops up in the news or whatever. It's like, nah, you know, that's old school. Yeah, next time you talk to your AI agent, it'll just say, oh, hey, by the way, I read this article you might be interested in.
So we've been talking a lot in the past few months about some of the Bitcoin yield, and there's some people that have been doing some things. There's a new one out there by Acre. It's this vault option in the form of an Acre that they think the initial APY is going to be about 14%, and it will auto compound in TBTC, which is on the Ethereum network. So they'll get this yield from activities like lending, liquidity provisioning on DeFi, staking, and they could, I guess, take a portion of the assets and bridge them to other networks like Starknet, which is specific campaigns. So they're capping the capacity of this. This first one out of like 5 Bitcoin, and then it'll be raised to 50 Bitcoin, but their longer term capacity is they think they can get to 200 to 300 million Bitcoin. And they do say 14% is probably going to be a lot. They think long term, the target is going to be about 5%. So for people that are looking for returns on Bitcoin, your yield on Bitcoin, that's one of the ways. I think it's still one of those that you and I have been burned so much on that, it's going to be hard to trust that for a little while.
No, there's no chance I'd do anything like that. I'm selling covered calls on IBIT shares. That's, to me, like, if you want to generate yield on your Bitcoin, that's your low risk move. You know, I don't know why. I mean, I guess other people don't do covered call strategies, but I mean, it's, you can do that. You don't need to put your trust in some company you never heard of that just started up and think they have an idea.
Another really interesting thing that came out. So Fedi, which is a Bitcoin company building on top of the open source Fediment protocol. It's a privacy-centric Bitcoin payments method using Chimerian eCash. So Chimerian eCash is way back in the day, one of the old cyberpunk solutions. It aims to make the creation of multi-signature eCash mints easy, private, and secure for communities. And it just takes a few clicks. So I think they were founded back in 2022. David Chaum's Chimerian eCash was from 1982. And it made it to, I think, almost every copy of Windows 95. But with all the centralization, it just couldn't really work out. So the Bitcoin community is kind of taking on this challenge, and they're creating this eCash alternative, and it looks pretty interesting. I looked into it a little bit, and I'll be intrigued to see how it takes off. But it's kind of one of those fun things that people are taking it and then using the Bitcoin network to really allow you to print money that is controlled by reserve and then it's private. So it's not on the Bitcoin ledger. It's on its own little privacy ledger. And it's kind of intriguing to see how this is going to play out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, play with it. Like, that's why it's there. Figure it out. So maybe this works, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it leads to something else. It's definitely, I don't know. There's so much going on. There's so much stuff that's getting tried. I feel like over time, because the ideas are going to come to the top, this could be one of them.
Parachain, we talked about them not too long ago, because I think there was an ETF that someone, or a treasury company that someone's going to base Parachain off of. They just had to pause their network, then execute emergency hard fork. They had an exploit in Balancer. I think about $128 million was drained from Balancer. The analysis from Nansen reports to a faulty access control check that allowed hackers to convert fake fees into real assets. So, yeah, once again, a lot of these chains are moving quickly and don't have it all ironed out yet. So be careful getting in early, because there may be some volatility.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely going to be volatility. I mean, Bitcoin's traded under $100,000 and everybody's freaking out. And it's like, you're in it for the volatility, guys. Like, volatility doesn't mean it goes up in a straight line. So, you know, yeah, buckle up.
SBF was in the news again. He claimed that FTX was never insolvent, and that if they had all their assets today, it'd be worth $136 billion, which is way more than the $8 million of liquidity issue that they had. Apparently, he's still trying to get Trump to pardon him. He's not apologizing for, of course, the secret backdoor that Almeida had to pull all their customer funds out and do whatever they wanted with. So he thinks he was still in the right, and hopefully we do not see a Trump pardon for SBF in the near future, or whatever.
If the argument is we were never insolvent, all we needed was a generational bull market and we would have been fine, then you were insolvent. All we needed was Bitcoin to go from $24,000 to $110,000 and we were A-okay. Where's my pardon? Like, no, you're in jail. You're supposed to be in jail. You screwed up. Eat it.
So the T3 Financial Crime Unit, which is a task force backed by Tether, Tron, and TRM Labs, it has announced it has frozen $300 million in tainted funds, and it just started about a year ago. So this has become kind of a global model for blockchain security, and it's earning a lot of praise from international law enforcement. So good to see that there's ways to track this down, and I know $300 million is still not a lot compared to what's being stolen in general, but at least they're making a dent in some of this, where with cash, you almost can't really do much of that at all.
Well, not only that, they're giving themselves ammunition for when they get called into Congress to talk about this, and Elizabeth Warren's going to say stuff about nefarious use and fraud and abuse and all these things, and they can say, look, here's our task force. This is what we do. It's way better than anything the government's ever done. Like, here's all the information. So, like, not only is that a good thing for, you know, keeping things on the up and up, but it's for, you know, future proofing your congressional hearings. That's a smart move, in my opinion.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about Fold over the years. What we haven't really talked about was the original owner of Fold was a company called Thesis. They incubated and spun out Fold. Thesis also owns Lolli, Well, Thesis just acquired Slice as well. So for those people that have Lolly or Slice, now you get both of them. Lolly was a way to get rewards from buying things online back in Bitcoin. And Slice is now a browser extension that allows users to earn Bitcoin while surfing the web. So it'll be interesting to see if one of these turns into something that they can spin out again and be a similar success level as Fold. But in the meantime, for those of you that have either Lolly or Slice, you pretty much get the benefits of the other one almost automatically.
Yeah. No, I like Fold. I'm still waiting on a credit card, though.
You and a lot of other people, that's for sure. Let's talk about some more RWAs. Ironbite Markets received the FINRA approval to regulate a U.S.-regulated alternative trading system for both traditional and tokenized securities. They're the first platform in the U.S. to enable atomic on-chain settlement, allowing trades to clear and settle instantly. So I think they're going to start with institutional participants across private credit, venture capital, and alternative investments before they expand to tokenized markets under regulatory oversight. So that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, I mean, RWAs are going to happen. I just don't know when, and I don't know in which sector, and I don't know which RWA token is going to be the winner or one of the winners. So it's worth paying a little bit of attention to, but for me, it's not a lot right now.
Yeah. And I think that's all I had. What else did I miss?
We had Bitcoin White Paper Day, October 31st. So that's 17 years of since the white paper came out. And I've been in Bitcoin for 8 years. So it won't be long before I got into Bitcoin in the first half of its existence. So as long as time keeps going forward, I will get earlier and earlier in the Bitcoin history. But I always think that's a cool one. It's a good chance to think about how cool it is that Bitcoin started as, as this kind of discussion thing, white paper, rollout, source code, Genesis block, and then, mining it. And then it was just wide open from there and set off into the world. And now we're talking about it, countries, institutions, BlackRock, all this stuff. And 17 years isn't that long. It's like for something to go this far without a CEO and just pumping a bunch of energy into it, it's just a bunch of people that figure it out and think it's great and talk about it and grow it. Come up and it's basically open source, so you can just build on top of it, Lightning Network and things like that. I mean, it's all the way down to creating a website, Bitcoin faucets, and you just play with it and it's neat and valuable. So I think that's always worth talking about every year, that Halloween is Bitcoin White Paper Day and it just keeps ticking along.
Yeah. More and more people are realizing how important it is. And I still think it's one of those things in the US, no one understands kind of the freedom technology side of things and how big a deal it's making for a difference outside of the US for people up there. But it is becoming more and more important. And I think it's actually going to probably become more and more important inside the US here pretty soon too, with the way things are going.
Yeah. I mean, when COVID happened, I got a phone call from a buddy and he was like, "Hey, what country are you bugging out to? if things get really weird, where are you going?" And, people have that kind of self-preservation mentality. And based on the political climate in the United States, man, if you have assets, if you're in New York City and you have assets, you're now going to get blamed for a lot of bad things. So you're going to need to travel, and traveling with gold isn't great. And if you don't trust the country, take care of your property and protect your property rights, then Bitcoin's great for that, to kind of skip out on all of the trusting other institutions to protect you stuff. So long way away from anything like that being a real concern, but I think some people have a personality type that forces them to think like this, and those people are going to start thinking like this if they haven't already. So I think the United States will start to pick up more steam, not just from the greedy number go upside, but also from the, hey, what happens if stuff really does start to suck here? What am I going to do? And so, yeah, Bitcoin. Cool. That's what I got.
Yeah, what a thought to leave people on. So talk again next week.
Well, it's personality types. There's a personality type that gets into Bitcoin early because you're curious and you're open-minded. And there's personality types that, build bomb shelters and safe rooms, and despite the fact that they live in happy suburbia. So you know, I think Bitcoin's just another avenue, another vehicle. I mean, if you're comfortable with like, hey, this thing's going to roll, this economy's going to roll, you know, pretty steady. We're going to have ups and downs, no problem. I've got real estate, I've got gold, I got Bitcoin, I got stocks, and my stock portfolio is balanced and all of these things. And, you know, that's great for some personality types. So I think that's one thing that doesn't get talked about very much is if you look at how many people are into Bitcoin, have mechanical engineering degrees and industrial or electrical engineering degrees, it's a lot of that. Like, it's not like a mathematician mindset. It's more of an engineer mindset that got in early. And then the next round is different. And then, you know, finance guy to get into it. So, you know, it kind of, like everything, Bitcoin kind of has that ratcheting impact of, all right, this personality type has a reason to get into Bitcoin. All right, we've got that one. Well, now we're spreading and we're talking to this other personality type, and we're, you know, it's got a use case for those folks. And so, yeah, that's, you know, it's worth talking about. Bitcoin touches everything. I've learned a lot in the 8 years I've been into it because I pay attention to Bitcoin, and it drags me into macroeconomics and nutrition and all kinds of different areas. And eventually it'll touch everything.
And the good news for everybody out there is Bitcoin's on sale right now. So enjoy while it lasts.
That's right. I mean, when I'm on this podcast for an hour, I don't know what the price is going to be, but I anticipate it being in six digits when I go check whenever it happens later today.
Awesome. Well, Hal, I appreciate the conversation, and we'll talk to you next week.
No, I appreciate it, Jason.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.